From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the magic of Coral Castle and anti-gravity with Joe Bullard. Get ready for that. But here's what's happening. Well, parents are beginning to hit their retirement accounts just to pay off student loans. The student loan debt amassed by parents growing faster than the loans taken out by the students. Parents' loan debt has more than doubled over the last decade, exceeding $100 billion, or 10% of all outstanding student loan debt. This is a crisis. It's a disaster. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the student loan scam with Alan Collins. Get ready for that. Iran proclaimed advances in nuclear know-how, including new centrifuges able to enrich uranium much faster, a move that may hasten a drift towards confrontation with the West over suspicions that it is seeking the means to make atomic bombs. Ryan Morrow, founder of WorldThreats.com and a fellow with Radicalism.org, continues to monitor the situation in the Middle East. Ryan, this is getting all too common. Major stories here. Israel accusing Iran of attacking their diplomats. Iran accusing Israel of doing things to its scientists. Something's going to happen soon. What's your gut tell you?
Something definitely is going to happen soon. By all accounts, everything is escalating. The proxy war, the tension between Iran and the Arab states, especially over the conflict in Syria, things are heating up. And Secretary of Defense Panetta was not bluffing when he said that there's a strong likelihood that Israel could strike Iran by June.
I think it could happen even sooner, don't you?
I think it could, but I think that the big sign that Israel is waiting for is for the uranium at that underground nuclear site that can withstand airstrikes to be enriched to 20%, because at that point, within about 6 months, Iran can get a bomb, and if Israel can't take out that site, then that's their last opportunity. So I think that the thing everyone needs to be watching for is when Iran kicks out the inspectors from that underground site at Fordo.
How do we know, Ryan, that they don't have the capabilities already and they have it in some other location?
There's just no intel. Well, first of all, there are probably secret sites involved in uranium enrichment, but it goes a lot beyond that. You have to put together all the components for a bomb. You have to develop the nuclear trigger. And it looks like we have some pretty good intelligence on Iran. If you look at what the IAEA reports have put out there, we've got some good information about some of their most secret activities. For example, the fact that they're preparing for an underground nuclear weapons test.
All right. We're going to monitor this situation. Thanks, Ryan Morrow. His website's part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. There is a restaurant chain out there called Heart Attack Grill. Strange name for a restaurant, isn't it? Well, listen to this one. A man suffered an apparent heart attack while eating a triple bypass burger at the Heart Attack Grill in Las Vegas. The man was eating by himself when he began complaining of chest pains, started sweating, stuttering his words. He was eating a 6,000-calorie burger, taken to the hospital, and he's still there. Cancer patients are now fighting for more than just their lives. They're battling to get their medicine, their chemotherapy. There's a shortage of chemotherapy medications in the United States right now. A big part of the problem is that many of the tried and true chemo drugs just aren't profitable. Dr. John Neustadt is a medical director of the Montana Integrative Medicine and is working with the FDA's Orphan Drug Division to create novel therapies for cancer. John, how serious is this shortage, and how needed are these chemotherapy medications?
It's extremely serious. In 2005, there were only 61 drugs that were in short supply in the United States, and that's grown to about 290 drugs currently. Very commonly used drugs like Taxol for breast cancer, methotrexate used for children with acute lymphocytic leukemia, Vidaza used for acute myeloid leukemia. Literally, there's a rationing going on, choosing pharmacists, oncologists, choosing who's literally going to get the life-saving drugs and who will die. And it's feeding an entire gray market in the pharmaceutical industry where, for various reasons, some of them shortages and problems with manufacturing, but with other drugs literally being held back so that those branded drugs can increase in price and the pharmaceutical industry can reap windfall profits while the generic drugs, which are not on the formulary list, are unable to compete or unable to be purchased. And so it's feeding that gray market and the appetite for profits in the pharmaceutical industry very effectively, while at the same time you have an FDA that has many rules and regulations, very good ones to protect us. However, many of those rules and regulations then stop those FDA officials from being able to actually use any judgment in allowing novel therapies to come to market faster to replace those shortages. For example, in our natural product we're trying to develop through the FDA for acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome, where over 6,000 patients that have used it for 6 years or more published studies showing it is absolutely safe. And in fact, it's available as a dietary supplement in the United States already, and yet they're requiring us to spend literally $7, $8, $9 million just to do safety studies alone, although it's has an incredible record.
Now, the shortage here, though, John, is it primarily because they're not making money with this stuff?
No, there are different reasons, actually. They are making money with them, but the problem is it depends on the drug. The market for orphan drugs is relatively small, maybe a few hundred or a few thousand patients. And so the manufacturing facilities are putting their manufacturing capacity into the blockbuster drugs.
I see.
Those capable of producing $1 billion or more in revenue. That's what's considered a blockbuster drug. And instead, then, they let the capacity in for these other drugs wither. So if there's one small problem, and production has to slow down for whatever reason, whether it's a real problem or an artificial one created by the company, to decrease the flow of that medication and increase the prices, then there's no excess capacity or other manufacturing facilities that can then increase their manufacturing capacity quickly to make up for that shortage.
Good point. When they shut down those lines or slow them down, then that's what happens. Thanks, John. Two dog owners filed lawsuit claiming that their pets were mutilated while being groomed at an Oahu pet store in Hawaii. The lawsuit filed in state court says that one plaintiff dropped off the dog, Dodo, for grooming at the Petco store. The pet was returned with its ear cut off. In addition, it looked like they tried to reattach the ear with glue. In another one, the dog, Hope, visited the store and came back with the tip of its tail cut off and bleeding. A Finnish sci-fi comedy about Nazis invading Earth has become the most talked about movie of the year in Berlin at its film festival. Iron Sky is a B-movie spoof that's been screened at the festival sidebar event called Panorama. The plot revolves around a group of Nazis who escaped to the moon at the end of World War II to plan a return assault on good old planet Earth. Okay, up next, we talk about the student loan scam. If you're a parent, if you borrowed money to put your kid through college, you don't want to miss this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Alan Collins is a founder of studentloanjustice.org, which is a grassroots organization started for the purpose of exposing blatant injustices in the U.S. student loan system and returning standard consumer protections to student loans. He's the author of The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History, and How We Can Fight Back. He was also selected as one of the 7 financial heroes by CNN Money Magazine back several years ago. Here's Alan back on Coast to Coast. Alan, how are you?
Good, George. Great to be with you tonight.
Likewise. So here we are, parents reaching into their retirement accounts just to start paying student loans. When does it end, Alan?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't end with their retirement accounts. In fact, we've documented dozens of cases where parents have, in fact, been forced into a sale of their home in order to bail their children out of this inescapable and highly inflated debt that student loans have become, not only for them, but for about 2 out of 3 of every college student in the nation. We recently passed the $1 trillion threshold in national student loan indebtedness, and this is only increasing at an accelerated pace.
Now, tell me where the student loan scam is, because, you know, aren't these parents willingly going out to borrow the money to put their kids through school? So explain the scam to me.
That's right. Well, first of all, there are almost no consumer protections for uniquely for student loans. In other words, nearly every fundamental protection that we just assume is in place for every other type of loan that we take doesn't exist for student loans. So this includes bankruptcy protections. They are absent for student loans. Statutes of limitations, truth in lending requirements, fair debt collection practices, even state usury laws and refinancing rights are not available for borrowers of student loans. And this is almost never made clear to the student prior to taking out the loans. And so what has happened is a lending system has evolved where the lenders, the collection companies, even the guarantors, and as a matter of fact, even the federal government are making money on defaulted student loans. And in fact, they are making more money than if the loans remain in good stead. So stepping back for a minute, this is a defining characteristic of a predatory lending system, right? I mean, would you want to take a loan out from somebody who you didn't realize actually wanted you to fail in the endeavor for which you were borrowing the money? Well, no, you wouldn't.
Of course not.
But in fact, this is precisely analogous to what is happening in the student loan industry. So this is the student loan scam, and it is causing just a broad and deep swath of economic destruction across the country.
What about the cost as well, Alan? I mean, isn't this ridiculous? They're spending this amount of money.
That's exactly right, Georgie. And in fact, this is really it's a 1-2 punch. And the inflation is the second punch in the student loan scam. And, you know, in this easy credit environment where the lenders want to heap as much debt on you as possible, and so too do the guarantors of the debt, and even so too does the federal government, well, we can see why Congress has very quickly and easily raised the federal loan limits year after year after year and allowed the colleges to raise their tuitions willy-nilly. And so the inflation that we see in the cost of education is a direct result of this removal of consumer protections from student loans.
And the other thing, Alan, that truly bothers me is these schools are pumping out these graduates, kids that go into college with high hopes, they come out with high hopes, and they can't find jobs in their degreed field.
That's right. And, you know, the schools have taken massive advantage of the vulnerability of the students and the uniquely sort of predatory nature of these loans. And so far, not even one college president has stood up to say, look, this is wrong. And, you know, sided with the citizens in certainly our quest and other groups' efforts to return at least nominal consumer protections to these loans. I mean, it's out of control, like the subprime home mortgage industry never was. And the colleges have a lot of answering to do for this.
Tim Conway Jr., who's on our Los Angeles affiliate KFI, just told me before I came on the air here with you that some schools like Harvard have billions of dollars put away from endowments. They're just loaded with cash. How'd they get that much money?
Well, you know, when you have a lending system that is essentially like a free ATM machine, you can see how, and it's not just the Harvards. I mean, quite frankly, some of the lower tier schools, as a matter of fact, a huge industry of these so-called for-profit institutions, you know, truck driving schools and ITT Tech and University of Phoenix and so forth, it turns out that these are the largest benefactors of this student loan system. So it's certainly not limited to the more expensive private schools, but it cuts across the spectrum. And truly, it's the middle class and sort of lower class students that are bearing the brunt of this. I mean, these people are devastated, and probably the worst case case, which you mentioned in the outset of the show, are parents, grandparents, and you know, aunts and uncles, and so forth, who unwittingly co-sign on this net on this debt, not knowing that it's got a very high probability of exploding into double, triple, quadruple, or even much more than they originally signed for.
And it's got to be one of the easiest loans you can ever get.
Well, I would say it is the easiest loan that you can get.
I mean, do they even do a credit check?
No. For federal loans, the only underwriting is, did the student get accepted into the institution? Yes or no?
That's it.
And you know, for graduate schools, there's actually no limit to the amount of money that can be borrowed. And it's like I said, we've recently crossed the $1 trillion debt threshold. But probably a more alarming statistic is the lifetime default rate. And again, this is never advertised or never disclosed by the lenders, by the schools, or even the Department of Education. The lifetime default rate, which is the standard default rate for federal student loans generally, to my best estimate, is greater than 1 in 3. It's probably may even have exceeded 40% as we speak. And so this is just a massive risk and a huge harm that is being imposed on the citizenry. It's like lambs at a slaughter. They have no idea going in that this debt instrument is so heinously harmful, potentially. But they find out only when it's too late that for many of our citizens, going to college turns out to be the worst thing they could have ever done.
And it's probably a payment for the rest of their life, isn't it?
That's right. Absolutely. There's no statute of limitations.
No. And and how many people, what's the percent, Alan, if you know, pay off their student loan debt or just continue to have to pay and pay and pay?
Well, that's a good point. I would estimate that certainly about 60% of borrowers make it through okay. However, 40% do not. Of those 40%, how many eventually pay off some greatly inflated amount? I'm not sure, but I can tell you this, that the federal government, who's the ultimate guarantor of the debt, ultimately recovers $1.22 for every dollar that it pays out in default claims.
Huh.
So, and this is like getting blood from a stone, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it would be possible, but in fact, you know, credit cards, for example.
So they're making a little profit.
Yeah, I mean, credit cards typically will settle for, you know, 10 cents on the dollar, 15 cents on the dollar for defaulted accounts, whereas the federal government is actually making money on these defaulted loans. And so clearly a lot of people are ultimately repaying their defaulted loans, but only a huge, just massive increase compared to the amount.
What would happen, Alan, to tuition rates if the federal government stopped backing these loans?
If the federal government completely pulled out of the student loan business, as some people actually, presidential candidates and others have proposed, my best guess is that, first of all, probably 40% of all colleges would shut down the next day. And many of them, this
wow.
is a very good reason, actually. Some of these for-profit colleges towards the lower end of the spectrum are providing a horrible education for, I mean, even charging a dime would be too much for these schools, and they deserve to be shut down. But ultimately, I would imagine the price would decrease by probably 40% within 1 or 2 academic
That's
years.
Dramatic. That's
yeah.
dramatic.
And while, you know, at studentloanjustice.org, we're not proposing an end to the Department of Education and the student loan system, you know, writ large, because, you know, I think it's quite important and useful that our citizens be able to, you know, go to college and get a good education. We do think very much that at the minimum, standard bankruptcy protections must be returned to this lending system. And if that were to happen, we would probably see a 10 to 15% decrease in the cost of college in fairly short order. And not a moment too soon, because, you know, rich or poor, whether you're paying for your kid to go to college or whether they're taking out student loans, this inflation is hurting everybody across the economic spectrum.
Are there some countries that allow their kids to go to school for free?
all over the place. And, I mean, Russia typically will provide a free college education to its citizens, given that they deserve to go. And their
yeah, I guess their qualifications are for.
Right. And on and on and on. I would say that, however, in England, for example, England is beginning to follow the model that was tried here in the United States successfully. And so England is about 5 to 6 years behind the United States, but they are headed down the same path that we now find ourselves.
Well, they should look at our playbook and run away from it. Alan, stay with us. Coming back for phone calls with you. Maybe parents have gone through this bizarre experience with student loans. And you want to share your story. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about anti-gravity devices and the incredible story of Coral Castle. Joe Buller joins us, so make sure you're part of that program. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're going to take your calls during the last half hour of this part of the program. We're with Alan Collins, of course, author of The Student Loan Scam. Alan, how did you get interested in this? Did you go through some kind of situation or what?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have 3 degrees in aerospace engineering from the University of Southern California. And unfortunately, my loans were thrown into default despite my best good faith efforts to maintain them in good stead. And this led me in my original $38,000 in loans had ballooned to over $100,000 with penalties and fees. So this got me quite curious, and I did some research, and I found out that, in fact, I wasn't alone, and that my lender, Sally Mae, and others had in fact been caught for purposely defaulting student loans without even attempting to collect on the debt. And so this got me very intrigued, and I began doing research, and this led to a seminal article by Bethany McLean of Fortune magazine, and shortly thereafter a top story on 60 Minutes, and it sort of went from there. But as I've been researching this issue and advocating for this on the Hill and throughout the country, Zuccotti Park, for example, the further we go down the road, the worse the problem becomes, and the more alarming the data presents itself.
Is this like the housing scandal?
This is very analogous to the housing scandal, but with one key difference. The difference is that where a misfortunate homeowner can, unfortunately for them, they walk away from the home and they're, penniless and naked. The student loan borrower simply can't walk away. There are no bankruptcy protections. There are no statutes of limitations. And so this is a bubble that bursts not on the bottom lines of, stock indices, but rather in the living rooms of the homes of citizens across the United States. It's far more sinister in many ways.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going to Edward in Wyckoff, New Jersey to start. Edward, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I'm 68. I'm on SSI disability. I've had a student loan from 20 years ago, Florida State University. I was in graduate school, a degree in library science. It proved to be worthless in spite of the fact I did 2 years of very hard and steady work. The amount borrowed was $20,000. It has now escalated to $58,000.
58 because penalties and fees, no doubt.
Well, interest.
Interest alone pushed it up that high.
There were some penalties and fees. I don't recall just how much, but the total amount is now 58 out of 20.
Yeah, they'll typically tack on 20% upon default, and then then the interest compounds upon that.
And what's the definition of a default, Alan? 1 month late?
No, it's actually 270 days late is technically when a default occurs.
But my question is, my Social Security income is $730 a month. That is my only income. What can I do? What can I do with this loan now?
There is nothing that you can do to protect your Social Security income if you have a defaulted loan.
Will they attach it? Will they take it?
They do. They take
the whole thing.
I believe it's up to 15%, possibly more, of your Social Security check above a certain amount. And so, indeed, this is probably one of the most unfortunate. Sure, besides parents and grandparents perhaps losing their homes because of their children's student loans, senior citizens having their Social Security and disability income taken for their student loans is just a horrible outcome. I mean, this is not the way a country should be treating its seniors. And that's why probably our second or third most important agenda item is that we believe that anybody over the age of 65 or anybody who is permanently disabled should have their student loans forgiven. And that is just, it's ridiculous that we as a country could stoop to such measures against our citizenry as a result of their student loans.
And Alan, this is an emotional loan. You know, first of all, what parent doesn't want their kid to attempt to go to school if they want to go to college? And I happen to believe that sometimes the best education is out on the streets. But if your child comes to you and says, you know, Dad, Mom, I want to go to college. And so you go out and you get the loan for them. It's easy to get, as you just said. And so, you know, in they are. And all of a sudden, little Johnny's been in school for 4 years, gets his degree, and you've got a bill for $65,000.
Yeah, that's right. Nearly every societal sort of message that the kids get, and the parents as well, are go to college, get an education. It's the best thing you can do. It's good debt, they say. The average college graduate makes $1 million more over their lifetime. Well, you know, these statistics are just fabricated. You know, you can look at people who took piano lessons versus people who didn't take piano lessons, and the chances are the people who took piano lessons probably earn, you know, something more than the other group over the course of their lifetime. There's this huge marketing mechanism that's just ingrained in our society, which pushes kids towards going to college and by extension taking out these loans. And so typically and the way the loans are branded and sold and advertised and so forth, people think that they're safe loans. You know, these are government guaranteed loans, and you know, so obviously they're safe and they're simple and they're fair and so forth. But in fact, exactly the opposite is the truth. And so I counsel people, number one, never co-sign on your children or relatives or friends' student loans.
Do you have to? Is that the only way the kid will get the loan?
Well, for certain types of federal loans, yes, you do have to. But there are another class of student loans for which you do not have to. Private student loans are increasingly requiring a parent or other relative cosigner. And again, no matter what, call it tough love or what have you, do not ever cosign on a student loan for a loved one. Just don't do it. It's the worst thing that you can do. I have seen families literally ripped apart by virtue of the fact that one co-signed on a loan for the other. It's just a horrible outcome, and taking that risk is just the probably the worst thing that anyone can do.
Black Hills, South Dakota. Michelle, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle. Thank you.
Hi, George. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
And for having this program. I have a similar situation to the previous caller. That I'm worried about the taking money out of the Social Security, but I guess if it could be limited to 15 or 20%, that makes me feel a little bit better.
It's like a garnishment or a judgment where I think they take, 20%, Alan?
I'm sorry?
A judgment or a garnishment, they can take up to what, 20%?
You know, I don't know the exact percentage on that for a garnishment, for a judgment for another situation.
I guess I was also wondering, he said something about when he defaulted, and my loan is really old, like the previous caller, but I found out in trying to come up with some arrangement with them, which there's like 15 different collection agencies, and they rotate. You know, if they can't get it out of you, they pass it on to the next one, and they can't get it out of you, and they pass it on.
That's right.
It gets tougher along the line. Huh?
A key point here is many of these collection companies, in fact, a majority of these collection companies, are actually owned by the lenders. So we have a completely conflicted arrangement here where the lenders, they make money on the loan if you don't pay, but they can make far more money on these loans when they default rather than remain in good stead. So these lenders, knowing that they have this subsidiary or two or three that are collection companies, will do whatever they can to make the borrower confused and throw up their hands and, you know, walk away and ultimately default the loan so that they can put on their collection hat and collect far more money on a vastly inflated loan down the road.
Does the lender get paid by the government that guarantees it in the event of default?
Yes, the lender gets paid typically about 99%. So nearly full book value is paid to the lender when the loan defaults.
Once it defaults and the lender's been paid, then who owns the note?
Well, the note goes to something called a guarantor. And there's a network of 35 or so guarantors across the country. And these guarantors set about the collection process. So they will attempt to, they will inflate the debt with penalties and fees and so forth. And it turns out that these guarantors, although they're nonprofits and they sound friendly and have these very gentle and public service-oriented missions, mission statements, in fact, these guarantors make, on average, 60% of their income from penalties and fees attached to student loan, defaulted student loan debt. Now, ultimately, the ultimate guarantor of these loans is the federal government. And so if the guarantors are unable to rope the borrower into some sort of a rehabilitation, quote-unquote, program where they can they inflate the loan, they rope the borrower into making a year's worth of payments that go directly to the guarantor and the collection company and don't touch the principal or interest, they repackage the loan. They attach their, again, another however many percent, 5, 10 or more percent in fees and repackaging fees, and then they resell the loan on the open market. And so, but ultimately, the federal government is the holder of the note at the end of the day. And even the federal government is making, like I said, a 20% net return on these defaulted loans. So the borrower just pays and pays and pays up and down the chain, all the way up to and including.
It's like one of those payday loan places.
Oh, it's worse. It's far worse than a payday loan. I mean, at least with a payday loan or a credit card, at the end of the day, there are bankruptcy protections in place. If, you know, if it gets, you know, if it turns into an avalanche of debt, you know, if a $10,000 note turns into $50, $60, or $100,000, which happens quite frequently with student loans, I might add. At least, you know, there's a panic button, which is standard bankruptcy protections, which will allow the borrower at least some recourse in bankruptcy court. Well, we don't have that with student loans, and so student loans, like none other, are a both predatory lending instrument, and it's just intolerable. I mean, in this nation or any other, but also inflationary, and we've already gone over the cost of college and how that's rising as a direct result of this predatory underpinning.
Okay, let's go to Joshua Tree, California. Michael's west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, George. Hi, Alan. Thank you for calling. I've got a very interesting scenario. I'm legally blind. I went to college, started in 05. I got a note from my doctor stating that I didn't have to do the maximum load. They're requiring, my requirement is 6, and that was asked by my doctor. The note went in, and of course, I took some student loans out. And then all of a sudden, I'm still in school. I've got 2 degrees, a criminology and a sociology degree, which I'm just now finishing out. And they sent me a letter saying in 15 days, you're going to be in default. So I called them up, and they had something called their ways to not default. And because I can't find a job, and I'm still in school, they don't consider me still in school, number one. Number two, most people on SSDI don't know this, but if you hit 55, then you give up all of your assets, if you own a home or so on and so forth. And so, I mean, it's kind of like a double whammy on the disabled individual. Plus, when talking to them, they said, okay, well, the only one that you qualify is for the inability to be employed. But they said in a contractual agreement, in order to keep it from going into default, that they're going to add interest on it. And then, of course, I've been listening to Alan, and I just, oh, my God, I'm mortified to see what the end game is. But what I don't understand is it's not a giving, it's a taking, it's a fleecing. It's actually nefarious what they're doing. And there has got to be, Alan, please, you stand up for the seniors, please stand up for the disabled, because many people don't know. I only make $730 a month, and I mean, I'm barely existing, right. And it's been a challenge. Do you have, can you speak at that?
I couldn't agree with you more, and as a matter of fact, you know, there are provisions in the law for discharge cancellation, as a matter of fact, of federal student loan debt for the cases of total and permanent disability, which I doubt that you fulfill that. But there it is. But having said that, the Department of Education typically will take somebody who is totally and permanently disabled, as certified by the Social Security Administration, and they will hire their own doctors and come in and say, "Oh no. This person is not totally and permanently disabled." And so it becomes a completely no-win situation. And oftentimes these people, you know, like yourself, living on a very, very moderate amount of income per month, find even that absconded by the federal government. And you're right, it's a fleecing. It's a wealth extraction mechanism by the federal government. And, you know, it's just intolerable in this country or any other. I mean, no country I know of treats its seniors like the Department of Education and the student loan system is allowing for our seniors and our disabled citizens to be treated. It's just unconscionable.
All right, let's go next to Shreveport, Louisiana. James, thanks for holding. Go ahead, James.
How you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
Alan, you need to write a book called The Great American Ripoff, and that's exactly what this is. I had a student loan 15 years ago. Now, they know they're going to get their money sooner or later. When you go to draw Social Security, it's under your Social Security number. They're going to get you.
Right.
But the sad part is I signed up for a school that's all the way in Florida from Louisiana, and I never heard anything for 5 years. I never heard a thing. I had forgotten about it. Then all of a sudden I get a bill that I owe or defaulted in a student loan. Well, I checked into it, found out the school no longer exists. But I did find out that I graduated. I never went, but I graduated. And it's for a truck driving school is what it was.
You know, I hear these types of stories again and again and again. These people have no ethics. They have no morals, and they have no compunctions about fabricating these certifications that you attended a school or graduated, and often it's years and years after a default when a borrower realizes that he or she actually had a loan in their name taken out. And of course, you know, the bureaucracy set up against the borrowers, it's almost always impossible to prove. And so these people in the position like you find yourself in, typically have no recourse. And ultimately, either you pay, and you pay, you know, five times what was originally borrowed on the loan, whether you went to school or whether you benefited or, you know, whatever the case may have been, or you live the rest of your life with this debt monkey on your back. And it's really wrecking the livelihoods of probably, my best guess is about 20 million people at this point are either in default or are facing default. And, you know, this is a scourge on the nation. And I can only hope that people will either form their own local organizations or come to studentloanjustice.org and support us by, you know, buying a T-shirt or what have you. It's really a grassroots thing. And George mentioned the wall that we are. And this truly is our, you know, this is our nation's constitution that is being tested here. And so the citizens really have to come together and throw this monkey off our back. I really believe that.
Okay, Alan, I want to thank you for being on the program. Good luck with your work, the student loan scam. And for all of you who have taken out student loans, I've done that for myself and for my two of my three children. It's not easy, I'll tell you that. Up next, Joe Buller joins us. We're going to be talking about several topics with Joe, including anti-gravity, what's going on there. Did a pilot truly see a UFO a long time ago? And then we'll talk about Coral Castle and how a 120-pound man moved tons of rock by himself.